Radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, the Prime Minister has warned European leaders they could regret the decision to nominate Jean-Claude Juncker to take over as the new President of the European Commission. Leaders at a summit in Brussels voted by 26-2 to back the move. David Cameron's concerned he'll try to block changes. There's the leaders working together to agree on an alternative candidate.
This is a bad day for Europe. It risks undermining the position of national governments. It risks undermining the power of national parliaments, and it hands new power to the European Parliament.
Police in Cornwall are looking for a 60-year-old Elvis impersonator who's believed to have access to guns. Officers want to talk to Daryl Weaver about a domestic-related incident at his home in Widegates last night. Bill Sharp lives nearby.
I've seen police up the end of the road and that there, and they said to look in, find out if I've got any shades, and to look in to see if there's anything around. But I said, mine is only those small shades and everything's all right around here.
City of London police are to look again at whether to carry out a criminal investigation into Wonga. It's after the payday lender sent out fake legal letters to customers. The company has apologised and promised to pay compensation. A man has been killed in Swindon in what police are describing as an extremely vicious attack. The local resident, thought to be in his 60s, was found dead on a cycle path near Swindon railway station last night with multiple stab wounds. A huge strike by public sector workers is a step closer after GMB union members voted in favour of taking action. Council staff, teachers and civil servants are protesting about a pay increase offer worth 1%. Unison has already voted to take part in the walkout on the 10th of July. Novak Djokovic is into the last 16 at Wimbledon. The top seed beat Gilles Simon of France in straight sets. Later, Andy Murray takes on Spanish 27th seed Roberto Bautista Agut. That's the latest. I'm Emma Jones.
Yes, it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, it's Glastonbury weekend, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news, it's Lib Dem councillor for King's Weston, Tim Leeman. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, hey ho, and off we go. Al Sisi's Egyptian junta have banned and sentenced to death hundreds of organisers in Egypt's democratically elected majority party, the Muslim Brotherhood, and they've jailed three Al Jazeera journalists for the heinous crime of telling the truth. In the same week, US Secretary of State John Kerry bowls up in Cairo and releases nearly $600 million to Al Sisi for a job well done. So, is it time to say bye-bye to the United States, who are bankrolling the world's dictators, and march them out of their UK bases? We talked to Lindis Percy from the Campaign for Accountability of American Bases, who's organising next week's Independence from America Day. Plus, as our support for Syria rebels backfires into Iraq, the World Health Organization's quietly refused this week to publish the findings of its report into Iraqi's birth defects and other mutations. They've been caused by Britain and America's use of depleted uranium ammunition in 1990 and the 2003 invasions. Joined by DU and Iraq expert Joanne Baker, and we look at the so-called ceasefire in eastern Ukraine. What's been going on now? Kiev and their separatists are out of the media spotlight. Plus, we ask, if we get time, how evil is North Korea, really? And have they got a point when they criticise the West? Plus, it's Martin's chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the weatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius and some heavy showers easing off as the night progresses. This weekend, highs of 16, some heavy and thundery downpours on Saturday, lighter showers on Sunday. Next week, highs of 21, fairly cloudy week with showers and sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 5th and 6th of July, highs highs of 21 Celsius, sunshine and showers again. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Lib Dem Councillor for King's Weston, Tim Leeman. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Good afternoon.
Just tell us a little bit about yourself. You've just got yourself re-elected, one of the few Lib Dems to do so, I think.
Yes, I have.
How did you manage that?
With difficulty, but successfully. I was elected in 2010, and I've just got another 2 years before we go to all-out elections locally. And of course, next year is further local elections in Bristol, and the general election. I was, you know, on a very small majority, but I managed to survive longer with
four. How did you do that? Because for many of the Lib Dems, they've just not managed to hang on because too many people, the voters are seeing Nick Clegg every time they're thinking about putting a cross in the Lib Dem box, aren't they?
Well, I think they were seeing me when they put an X in the box on this occasion, hopefully. On a local level, it's all about the hard work. And, you know, I was rewarded for that over the last 5 years.
So give us an idea of what you've been up to then.
Yes, I mean, in the previous administration, we put in a considerable amount of money for play areas, and we've produced that. In my area, we've got one in Lawrence Weston, we've got another one coming in Sea Mills, we've got another one in Lawrence Weston as well, actually. And there are a number of local issues that you take an interest in and get involved in, and local groups, and I'm a very active councillor.
Okay, so King's Weston, what are the local issues around there?
Well, we started off with housing issues, for example, in Lawrence Weston, and we formed the Lawrence Weston Planning Group. We also have Ambition Lawrence Weston.
Okay, what does the planning group do then?
Well, we meet every month and we discuss planning issues, and we're in the process of putting together a neighbourhood plan, which will go to referendum in about a year's time, and we discuss local planning issues, and we invite developers to come along and tell us what they're planning to do locally, and we discuss the prospects for initiatives such as community-led housing.
So, but you can't really do a lot about that, can you? If a developer decides they want to do something, there's not a lot locals can do these days.
Well, we can. I mean, the neighbourhood plan will give us a policy, a planning policy that will run alongside the councils, and that will give us some clout as to the objectives that we'd like to achieve. And, you know, if we can push that through, that will give... You say I'm a great believer in empowerment of communities. And empowerment is really the answer to our problems in these days, with money being short and the council cutting and
what, the big society?
Else.
This is... Because you're in Charlotte Leslie territory, aren't you? The czarina of the big society.
Yes, I think we've gone beyond that. I mean, empowerment is really, for me, a local thing. So, as I say, the idea is to help the community... connect with the council and use the council's assets and ability to help that community produce things such as and involve itself and promote such things as traffic schemes, as I say, play areas, planning groups, housing issues, employment, transport and so forth, and meet with the providers. And also we've got a very large community sector group, which is a group of local providers, and we've got community involvement, and that is the key thing. You must have resident involvement.
But a lot of people just don't have the time to get involved with these community groups, Tim, do they?
They don't. And I think these days in any community you'll find that it's difficult. But we work very hard the last 2 years. Lawrence Weston, for example, has a former college site, City of Bristol College site, which is half owned by the council, half owned by the City of Bristol College. That has now been demolished, and we're looking at a supermarket. The community wants a supermarket through its community plan that we did a couple of years ago. So the whistle stop tour is out of that. Hopefully we'll have a community health hub, we'll have housing there, but we are developing the community.
Are you able to squeeze a bit out of these developers? You say, well, yes, you can build your supermarket.
Well, I'm sure that will count.
But you can have your supermarket, but we want this, this and this as well.
Well, you're always negotiating. I mean, the key thing is you have to do it by stages. So we have a design brief, and then we move on to the process of demolition for the site, and then we have developer interest, and we believe that that is the case. So, or we hope that will be the case. So, you know, you go stage by stage, and eventually you reach your goal. It takes time, and I think you have to be patient. Well, the big thing is patience. But we're very determined to succeed for our communities. I'm particularly determined to succeed for King's Weston, okay, which includes Lawrence Weston, Sea Mills and Coombe Dingle.
What about the bigger picture from Westminster, the financial situation in the country? Because the Lib Dems do have a say. They don't seem to have much of a say, but they certainly are supposed to be having a say. So do you think your party is batting up at Westminster as it should be, you know, for your local constituents in your area?
Well, I'm certainly batting for my local area. We don't have a Lib Dem MP in Bristol North West. I believe we would be better off if we did, but we are where we are. The party is not the biggest, but we believe that a substantial amount of good things, such as if you earn less than £10,000, you don't pay tax, and the pupil premium and so forth, these are the things that have come out of our side of the coalition. The Conservatives are not our natural allies. I think a lot of people would feel that. But on the whole, I think it's been a very stable 5 years.
I mean, the national debt is now around about £1.3 trillion. It's growing and growing. It's never going to be paid off. Anyone that says it is, I think, is talking poppycock. And more and more of what we do is going to pay off that interest on that enormous national debt. We're dealing with the City of London, which seems to be more powerful, really, than the politicians.
Well, the economy is the key, isn't it? You know, you turn the economy around, and the theory is that things start to get better. You know,
has it turned around, in your view?
I think it's got a way to go. You know, you know, when you ask people, do they feel the key test for me is, do you feel better off? And if you don't, then the economy isn't really working for you. You know, if your wages aren't going up or your salary's not going up, then you're going to feel it in your pocket. It's a difficult one to answer in a sense, but I think the real test is how people feel about it.
Okay, before we hear from Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, Ian Fraser, who's been on this show a couple of times, he's a financial journalist from the Sunday Herald, and he's been on the BBC, various other places. He's just got a new book out called Shredded, and he appeared on Russia Today on their programme, The Kaiser Report. So here's a edited down version of what he has to say about Shredded, which is all about Fred Goodwin, Fred the Shred, and RBS.
Time now to turn to Ian Fraser, author of this new blockbuster book, Shredded, Inside RBS, the Royal Bank of Scotland. Ian, welcome to the Kaiser Report.
Thank you, Max.
When we talk about the Royal Bank of Scotland, the name Fred Goodwin comes up. He's kind of the key player. It's been a couple of years since the whole thing went down, but just fill the folks in on Fred Goodwin and mention some of the excesses that you detail in the book about Fred's behavior.
Okay, well, Fred was an accountant. He became the chief executive of RBS in March 2000. He was a deal monger. He made loads of takeovers of other banks, which he didn't properly evaluate prior to the acquisition being carried out. Classic example was Charter One, Cleveland Bank, which he bought in 2004 for $10.5 billion. It was later revealed to be worth about $1.5 billion, or he massively overpaid for it. He loved all the kind of trappings that went with being the head of a global bank, because he loved having, you know, fleets of Mercedes, he loved the private jet.
Yeah, I get the impression, reading the book, he becomes like a ghetto pimp. So here you have the ghetto of financial fraud, and there's Fred Goodwin, you know, flashing his cash like a pimp. And the rest of the banking industry, they emulate that. They're like, you know, yeah, we want to be pimps too. So H-Boss, you know, when we've had Paul Moore on the show, the whistleblower, about how H-Boss was a turn into a hellacious whorehouse of debt. Mm. And then you've got also Neil Mitchell, who talks about the RBS becoming a whorehouse of debt. Mm. But this is really the definitive text. I think of Barbarians at the Gate that came out about Colbert, Craverson, Roberts, and the RGR Nabisco deal. This is going to be a classic. It's an instant classic. I just want to skip to the present, because
yes,
this RBS scandal is growing. They quote, RBS could fail with £100 billion of black hole today. The British taxpayer is in line to lose their entire £45 billion stake that they used to bail them out.
The problem is that when Gordon Brown bailed out the bank in 2008, he didn't properly sort it out, and nor has Stephen Hester, the guy who was the chief executive from 2008 through to 2013. There's still some serious problems inside the bank. There's a lot of misvaluation of assets still, I believe. There's also a lot of, I call them unfunded liabilities, to do with future litigation, which relate to LIBOR. They've already been fined, you know, massive amount of money for fiddling the LIBOR rate. But the true fallout of that hasn't fully been felt. There are quite a lot of court cases ongoing in the US whereby they could lose up to $80 billion, according to one analyst called Sandy Chen, just on those court cases alone. That's just for LIBOR. They also have a current ongoing criminal investigation involving multiple regulators around the world into market manipulation of foreign exchange rates, spot rates. This could have serious consequences for RBS. There are also ongoing inquiries into money laundering by its US arm, Citizens Financial, which, by the way, might become very difficult to sell because it failed its stress test from the Federal Reserve stress test earlier this year. So there are a lot of these sort of submarine issues within the bank, which they don't fully fess up to, relating to past misconduct. And the misconduct didn't solely happen on Fred Goodwin's watch. A lot of it carried on, or in fact got worse, after Stephen Hester took over as the chief executive.
Let me jump in, because you may, on that list of wrongdoings, one stands out: mispricing assets. In other words, you have a bank, they've got assets on their books, they submit to regulators what they believe these assets are worth. And they claim they might be worth 100 cents on the dollar based on a model. But the resale value of these assets might be only 5 cents on the dollar. And this is a pattern of fraud and abuse. And it's not by accident that they are mispricing these assets. They're doing it on purpose. Now, they would claim, I believe, that they're doing so because they got the advice from their accountants. Who is RBS's accountant?
It's a firm called Deloitte, who have been the accountant since 2000. It's quite interesting about that.
How is it different than Arthur Andersen and Enron? Arthur Andersen and Enron, they cooked Enron's books for years. Then suddenly they said these assets are worth nothing, and the bank vaporized in a day. Why is RBS and Deloitte and Touche not the exact same thing played out over again?
I think it's partly because it was bailed out by the government. Therefore, the government has a vested interest in perpetuating the misrepresentation of these asset valuations. The government now has an 81% stake in RBS. It doesn't want to admit the real state of its balance sheet, the truth. What is very odd about the bailout was that they retained Deloitte's. They didn't fire Deloitte's on the 13th of October 2008 when they gave it the largest bailout in the world. They actually kept them on. Now, that is very strange, considering presumably Deloitte's had been doing a pretty bad job of auditing this bank when it said it was making profits of $10 billion.
Okay, you say it's doing a bad job. Okay, but isn't that just a euphemism for criminal behavior? Because they get caught, as does PricewaterhouseCooper, KPMG, and Ernst & Young, with repeatedly a serial abuse of the law. They appear to be serial financial lawbreakers. And the government is in bed with Deloitte and Touche on this occasion.
They are.
Given the fact that the taxpayer owns Royal Bank of Scotland, isn't that an offense under some kind of offense above and beyond just incompetence?
One could argue it's a fraud on the public. If I had been Gordon Brown and if I had been bailing out RBS on the 13th of October 2008, I would have fired Deloitte. I wouldn't have kept them on. They had not been doing their job properly as auditors of that bank. The statements that were published up to December 2007 are, in my view, fraudulent.
Martin, that's Ian Fraser there talking to Max Kaiser on the Kaiser Report about his new book, Shredded, about Royal Bank of Scotland and the bailout. You know, the pair of them went through lots and lots of different subjects and aspects to the bailout there. The October 2008 bailout, £45 billion. And apparently now we may not get any of that back. That's what they're suggesting.
Yeah, I think, but the crucial point I took from that was the point Ian was making, that once the government has taken the bank over, they've then got a vested interest in trying to cover up previous malfeasance, and also, of course, this whole mark to magic as opposed to mark to market of what are the assets on the books. And RBS isn't the only one. The entire banking system is only solvent through, basically through accounting fraud, and because they're all at it, and they all, and any attempt to get to the bottom of it, send people to prison, confiscate their assets and so on, would create such a shock in the system that the system would then collapse. They've kind of got a blackmail hold over the government. I mean, RBS's assets on paper are far bigger than the British economy, so there's absolutely no way, Jose, that Britain can bail out RBS if it is bankrupt. I'm afraid it is. And of course, if we do lose the $45 billion that's been put into RBS, that means that the debt and the deficit is far worse than anybody realises, and that, I'm afraid, is the reality. What's happened in the last 5 years since the bailout is everybody's got used to the idea of quantitative easing and bailouts, and it's all normal. But of course, it isn't normal. It's very, very abnormal.
What about there's another, I think, 30-something billion, which was given to Lloyds as part of their bailout. How much of this is the public ever going to see back, or are we going to see none of it?
Do you want my honest answer? None at all. These banks are going to crash. Something will happen, maybe because of an invasion of Syria, or a face-off with the Russians, or Fukushima going down the drain, or Greece suddenly defaulting, or Argentina defaulting. That's definitely coming up this week. Looks like Argentina will default because the vulture funds have decided that they're going to get their pound of flesh out of Argentina. There's so many things that could cause the crash. And when it comes, it will be much more devastating than 2008, and the political class right, left and centre will be left absolutely hopeless, because nobody is telling people.
But why is no,
this
why,
is what they need to
I mean, if what
about.
You're saying has got some shred of truth to it, then why is nobody actually been preparing for this?
Well, I hope that the British civil service at the top levels are preparing for it.
Martin's message to the Treasury civil servants.
Don't forget, if you are top civil servants in the Bank of England or whatever, you don't go around saying crash, crash, crash. It's like shouting fire in a theatre. On the other hand, when the fire breaks out, one hopes that somebody's got a plan.
Tim, I just wonder if it's possible to relate some of this, what we've been hearing about the dodgy stuff going on in the city, and possibly people just not fessing up about how bad things are there, and whether these banks are, which are now largely publicly owned, many of them anyway, Lloyds and RBS are actually solvent. And how does that relate to, you know, what you do as a local councillor?
Well, it's somewhat remote, clearly. But, I mean, as I've said, you know, the economy turns around. People will feel it in their pocket. If things are as bad as Martin has suggested, then it would also include, there's been a lack of political intervention. There's a problem there.
He certainly doesn't seem to be the strongest character, does he, George Osborne? I mean, you get the idea. I think he was called the Oik, wasn't he, at Oxford?
Well, there might be a lot of things we don't know about.
The man who was easy to push around, basically.
I don't know. I don't know him.
Yeah, he was, anyway.
He's only a baronet. That's why he's an Oik.
I mean, I wouldn't want to speculate, you know, too much about things that I'm not particularly involved in. But I think as a local councillor, I think we do feel, particularly in you know, the wider world, that we don't really know what goes on. And it seems to me that there is a bit of a disconnect between the way things are designed and organised at, as you say, between banks and government. And that perhaps in a way it's the loss of the traditional banking that used to happen in the high street, you know, where you go and see your bank manager, you knew what your bank was doing. We don't seem to know what banks do anymore.
Well, I mean, quite often you go into a bank and there is no manager. It's just they are somewhere, maybe remotely, on a phone at the end of a digital link somewhere. But
one of the problems seems to be that there's nobody in the bank, there's no checks and balances. And nobody's really overseeing what goes on.
Martin, just finally, can you just talk about, because we heard about Deloitte's there and the fact that they're still doing the accounts for RBS, even though, as we know, in 2005, 6, 7, they did made a bit of a mess of it. In fact, they got the accounts all wrong, but it seems that they've been kept on.
Yeah, well, coming back to what Ian Fraser was saying, there's a temptation for the government to cover all this up because they are now 81% shareholders in the bank. So you could do what should have happened in 2008. Once you've actually got a situation where government is bailing out the private banking system, which is completely against the free market playbook. Let's get that absolutely clear. We have conservatives on this show who say, well, we had to bail the banks out. And of course, there are real free market economists, the von Mises Institute and so on, who say, well, no, you don't. You let them crash. But of course, then, of course, you're facing
the public lose their money. The businesses lose their money, don't they?
Well, that's right. And that's the reality of free market capitalism with no safety net. That means you can lose all your money in an accidental crash. And if you don't want that, you've got to have a safety net. And if you've got to have a safety net, you don't allow retail banking and investment banking to get mixed up. In fact, they were separated quite deliberately in the United States in the 1930s to prevent exactly what happened in 2008.
Of course, we had calls for that, didn't we?
I think the lack of involvement, you know, the public are not involved. And that we're on the receiving end, effectively. You know, the customer and the client is on the receiving end. And then we hear about these disasters, and we know nothing about them. And I think one of the problems is a disconnect between, you know, us, the man in the street, and what goes on in these senior funds, because it affects us all. Affects savings, affects pensions, it affects everything, and we're all paying for it.
Well, what tends to happen, of course,
is that the accountability is the issue for me.
They don't want people to talk too much about this stuff. Is the reality. Just leave it to us. It's too complicated. You don't understand it. Leave it to us.
Yes,
and I think people are prepared to let that happen as well. And that's why you end up with a problem.
Yes. I mean, I can see the logic of that. But we have got a problem, it seems, or we've had a problem. Will it ever be cleaned up, I guess, is the question.
OK, on to other news. Jimmy Savile, sickening and prolific reign of terror, which spanned five decades. We hear this week from the report from the 30 or so hospitals where he was conducting his abuse. Tim Lehman, this is pretty shocking, really, I think, for many people. Grew up with Savile, thinking he's just a friendly, nice guy. To what extent, though, do you think there was complicity within the system? I mean, it's quite clear people were making complaints over decades, something like 5 decades, about Savile. Nothing seems to have really ever been done about it, though.
Well, I wouldn't want to speculate about complicity, because that would be, I think, a legal matter for the police and the courts and investigation, you know, process. But you're kind of hard. I mean, you look at this and you just think, you know, I mean, I remember Jimmy Savile when he was on the telly. You know, it's unbelievable, actually. But we have the reality in front of us. And, of course, there's a report out today that sheds even more light, which is even more shocking. So, what could, you know... appalling, I think, is the word I would sum it up with, as, you know, an appalling story.
One of the things I was quite shocked about was actually how difficult it was to tell the story, even after he died. I mean, for obvious reasons, he's quite a wealthy guy. If you're going to print something about him when he's alive, he may sue you for libel and all that sort of thing. A lot of the newspapers were nervous about that. But after he was dead, in December 2011, it was Liz McKean at Newsnight that interviewed some of his victims. She went to her boss, I think it was Tim Rippon at Newsnight, and said, look, we've got this story, and they basically said, no, you're not putting that on Newsnight, because we've got some tributes to Jimmy Savile coming up at Christmas. So eventually Miles Goslett, as a freelance journalist in London, managed to get it printed. He went to all the national newspapers, who all said no, and he managed to get it printed in Richard Ingram's magazine called The Oldie in March 2012. And then the shocking thing for me, though, is that we've only just heard at the end of last month and beginning of this month, Richard Ingrams has now been sacked as the editor of The Oldie by his publisher. And almost all the best of the staff of The Oldie have also left en masse. So if Miles Goslett was to try and get this story published now, he might find nowhere to publish it.
Yes, you're saying the man who broke the story is who do you go to, I suppose, would be the issue. And... yes, I mean, how do these things how do these things come out if there's ever a need in the future?
Martin.
Well, I mean, obviously I'm as shocked as everybody else, but I mean, I think you see, I hate to bring this up, it's not a party political point, but Cyril Smith got away with doing some pretty nasty stuff for many years. And if you've got a certain degree of social cachet, it's possible that you can protect yourself. And this is, you know, it's always been true, but it's still true. There's one law for the rich and there's one law for the poor.
Also, there did seem to be some sort of help from Savile, either witting or otherwise, from people. I mean, Edwina Curry, who gave him a job, even though he didn't have any qualifications for it, that enabled him to pursue his abuse when she was a Tory health minister. And also, Prince Charles. Now, he kept talking about having friends in high places. This is how, one of the reasons, ways he intimidated people he abused not to report it. And also, he was meeting in Leeds with the police at breakfast clubs every Friday morning. He would have breakfast with some of the senior police in Leeds, where he lived, and one must assume that they would have been privy to some of the allegations against him. It's impossible to imagine that none of these allegations got to those police. So he definitely did, Martin, have friends in high places, didn't he?
Well, he did, and he was not the only one. I mean, what one worries about is who else is doing these things that we don't know about.
Well, you use the present tense there, and that's why I brought up this issue of the editor of The Oldie, which was the only person who published this, being sacked. Could this sort of thing, do you think, happen today?
Listen, abuse of children and the vulnerable is a sad fact of our society at every level. I think also the other thing that happens is that paedophilia is used as blackmail, political blackmail. So, for example, Ken Livingstone, when he made a maiden speech to when he first became an MP, he made his speech about the Kinkora Boys' Home in Northern Ireland, where MI5 had basically used it as a honey trap, encouraging political activists, mainly loyalists, paramilitaries, to go in there, have sex with underage boys, make sure that they were photographed and videoed, and then use it as political blackmail. I mean, people used to be blackmailed for having homosexual affairs. That's more difficult these days because homosexuality is much more acceptable, although it still goes on. But of course, paedophilia is still the blackmailer's pièce de résistance.
Well, Tim, I suppose one of the positive things that's come out of this, if you can call it that, is that actually people who are abused now do feel more able to talk to their friends, relatives about it, and more importantly, maybe go to the police. But what's your thoughts on that main issue I brought up with Martin there, which is, could this happen again?
Well, things can always happen again. I mean, there's always the potential for that. I think the way to stop it is to report it early and not be afraid about it. And clearly there was a lack of reporting, or if there was reporting, it wasn't acted on. So hopefully we can learn something.
One of the interesting things I felt about Peter Rippon at Newsnight, who spiked this story, tried to stop the story of the decade coming out, is all they did with him was they shifted him sideways, gave him another senior job in charge of, I think it was the BBC's archives or something. So it doesn't really send a red light on the topic when you act like that. Interestingly enough, of course, David Lowe, who's a presenter on the BBC, for doing an incredibly minor infringement, almost piffling in comparison, was sacked. So one must wonder how on earth the BBC dream up their priorities. But anyway, revealed how police tried to cover up spying operations on fracking protesters, but didn't realise that changing the text colour on the report uncovered crucial redactions. Anyway, they sent a report, which the police had done an internal report to the protesters, but all they'd done is they'd changed the text colour on it. So when some smart protester went in and changed the colour of the text on his computer, all of the stuff that was supposed to have disappeared reappeared. But that's not the main issue here. The main one is, Tim, is it right for the police to be actually, sending undercover police in, infiltrating the fracking, people protesting against fracking?
Well, I think this is one for Martin, actually. So I'm going to have to make a comment on this while I think about what I might say or not.
Well, I mean, obviously, we're more and more is being uncovered about what I think is unacceptable police infiltration of political organisations. So the Special Demonstration Squad, operating from 1968, was actually having undercover officers who were having sex with their targets, giving them babies, and then disappearing into the supposedly.
I don't think there's a suggestion that they've been having babies with the fracking.
No, but
protesters.
You'll understand why we're not in those circumstances. And when the Stephen Lawrence campaign was campaigning against, against the Metropolitan Police were being infiltrated, there's bound to be a question mark: is there proper control over police infiltration of political structures and organisations? And I'm afraid the answer has to be no.
I think Martin is arguing something of a history here. There's something of a history. And,
exactly.
These things don't happen by accident. I think that's what's being suggested. And
I mean, the police would argue, wouldn't they? Well, look, these guys, they may come and break the law, so we need to know exactly what they're doing. It's a good idea to have a couple of undercover police in there.
Well, the police may well take that view. We're not privy to how they operate. But, I suppose from a democracy point of view, it is rather hard to understand exactly why.
Should public money be spent on that? I mean,
well,
that's the point, isn't it?
Is public money being spent on it? Is that the accusation?
Well, yes, it is, yeah.
If you're saying the police.
It has been, certainly. Mm. Anyway, also on fracking, Putin has a spy plot to halt fracking in the UK, warns the chief of NATO. Agents are working with green campaigners to make sure Europe still has to rely on Russian energy. this is NATO Secretary General Rasmussen is saying that Vladimir Putin's government has engaged actively with green groups and protesters in a sophisticated operation aimed at maintaining Europe's reliance on energy exports from Moscow, said NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen. Martin, this is a bit of a strange one.
It's pot kettle black, really, because NATO, of course, Victoria Nuland admitted that NATO had spent, or the US State Department had spent $5 billion in the Ukraine supporting groups which they were happy with to overthrow the Yanukovych government. So if the Putin was spending a bit of money on Greenpeace, it would only be quid pro quo. But I think in actual fact this is laughable. I mean, Greenpeace and the Russian regime are actually at loggerheads. Many people think Greenpeace actually pick on the Russians rather more than they ought to. So I think Rasmussen's way off beam here.
Tim?
Yes, it sounds like speculation to me. That's a bit,
Well, Vladimir Putin's repeatedly voiced concerns about fracking, once telling a global economic conference that black stuff comes out of the tap if you do fracking in the local area. A Greenpeace spokesman said the idea where puppets of Putin is so preposterous that you have to wonder what they're smoking over at NATO headquarters.
Well, I don't think we better comment there.
Anyway, so, yeah, but on the principle, do you think this is just total and utter rubbish from NATO here?
Well, it's again, it's a speculative story, and who knows?
Well, this is what Rasmussen's saying. Well, would you agree with him?
He's entitled to his opinion.
Okay.
I'm sure.
Do you believe him, Martin?
No, I mean, basically, NATO have been involved in all sorts of bad behaviour over the years, which I can and do frequently mention on this programme. I'm not going to repeat myself for the umpteenth time. But NATO, in fact, requires police investigation. Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, was absolutely clear on that. He sees NATO's hand behind most terrorism in Italy in the 70s and 80s.
Friends of the Earth, who were on here last week, their head of campaigns, Andrew Pendleton, was equally dismissive. Perhaps the Russians are worried about our huge wind and solar potential here in Britain and have infiltrated the UK government, he says. Anyway, exclusive, a major murder case has collapsed in a new police corruption scandal. This is another corruption scandal. This is what Tom Harper last Friday, actually missed it last week, but in the Independent. This is just really another, we keep hearing, don't we, with the Savile and all these various police scandals, oh, it couldn't happen again. Well, it is happening. This case is just this year. Leila Halliday, who was involved in this murder case, my relative was anyway, recalls one of the police officers identified by the Independent visited her home a couple of weeks after her father's murder. She said, he was asking me where all my dad's money was. It was an odd question. It made me more suspicious. My dad's flat was ransacked after he was killed, and we thought the police had been going through things which didn't really relate to the investigation at the time. We just assumed they were doing their job. Now, really, if you haven't really got time to go into all the details of this case, but it's just another example of people who are rather shocked to find that even on a serious murder case, the Met Police have come in to investigate and they've found massive incompetence. In fact, when it finally came to the trial of the defendant, the Crown Prosecution Service and the police offered no evidence at all. Martin, we'll just start with you on this, because one of the most important things he's saying here is that there are skeletons in the closet at the Metropolitan Police, and they are just simply never been dealt with.
Well, listen, I mean, let's face, when we're talking about specific cases of police corruption, is there police corruption, dear listeners? The answer is yes, there is. And there's always been police corruption, and there always will be. The question is, do we have procedures in place to deal with it? And that's the serious question. And the whole Stephen Lawrence affair, for example, the root of that was that the lads who probably did it, their father was a major drug dealer who had police officers on the payroll, which is why they thought they could get away with it. So before it became a political case, it was actually to do with criminal corruption in the police. Now, that's not to accuse all police officers of being corrupt. That's absurd. Some are, some aren't. And it's just the real world.
Tim, a police source familiar with this case, said the news will cause utter chaos inside the Met. You can't mess about with murder. It's the most serious offence on the books. He goes on to say, I'm afraid there's a cancer at the heart of Scotland Yard that has never, ever been dealt with.
Well, I think it's a brave decision to print the story. And it's, you know, it's challenging the police, isn't it? And they will have to defend themselves on this this sort of accusation. Of course, a lot of these stories do actually highlight, you know, you sort of read them and think, well, I don't know, and then there's an investigation and people start to come out of the woodwork and say, well, actually I know something about this, or I know something about this, and the momentum starts to build. So I think, you know, I think I would say that the fact that the story's been printed is actually quite brave.
Okay, yeah, that was in the Independent, that one.
Yeah.
Back to Bristol now, and this is actually a national story, but it's Bristol University that have been saying that the largest UK poverty study in Britain is calling on the government to tackle rising deprivation. The percentage of households who fall below society's minimum standard of living has increased from 14% to 33% over the last 30 years, despite the size of the economy doubling. This is one of the stark findings from the largest study of poverty and deprivation ever conducted in the UK. This is a press release from Bristol University. They're saying that around 5.5 million adults go without essential clothing in Britain. 2.5 million children live in homes that are damp, and 1.5 million children live in households that cannot afford to heat the home. One in four adults now have incomes below what they consider is needed to avoid poverty, and one in every six adults, that's 17%, in paid work are poor. More than one in five adults have had to borrow in the last year to pay for day-to-day needs. And I suppose, in a way, Tim, that's that last one that says more than anything else, that these are people who've got jobs, but one in five of them are having to borrow just to make ends meet.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reading here a trend that, you know, over the last 30 years, despite the economy growing, we're actually parts of society are worse off. So, you know, but the actual deprivation described is pretty shocking. I must admit, as a ward councillor, I often see issues that come to light that do spark a similarity to some of the comments around, you know, the standard of housing, you know, earnings potential, and so forth. And we are a rich country. In fact, you know, if we look at a more local level, Bristol's a rich city.
Well, the sixth richest country in the world, I believe.
Yes. It is quite a surprising survey. I think what I find quite surprising, we've got a survey like this, as you say, with, you know, we are a fairly wealthy country, and yet we're looking at figures from a survey, you know, done by a reputable university. So quite worrying trend. That's
Martin, a third of us adults, the survey says, currently in employment, 35% are in exclusionary work. That means they're in poverty, low-quality work, and have experienced prolonged periods of unemployment in the last 5 years.
Well, I think this trend is over the last 30 years. So that includes 14 years of Labour government. And I think what's happened in my lifetime, I'm 54, is that society in my childhood in the 1960s was gradually becoming more equal. There were opportunities opening up for people which had not been there before, and because of, you know, the strength of the trade unions and various other things like of that sort, there was an increasing egalitarianism in British society. But of course what we've seen is a massive reversal of that because of changes in policy at the top. Effectively, people have decided at the top, and including New Labour, that it doesn't matter if people at the bottom are poor, provided the economy is growing, provided some people are making money. Ultimately, of course, that all came to grief in 2008.
Okay, I've got a controversial...
I don't think we've got the whole story here, by the way. You know, we've got a particular survey looking at particular issues. So, as ever, there will be other things that we possibly don't know about around this.
Also, I mean, isn't there a basic thing, Martin? I mean, this is from an economics point of view. Look, if people can get things for free, which is great when there's not much money around, that actually seems to be surely bad for the economy because it's not showing on the GDP figures.
Well, no. There's arguments about GDP figures. For example, every penny that's spent on the National Health Service is just added to GDP. If you fight a war, that's added to GDP. If you have an oil spill, that's added to GDP, and then the cleanup's added to GDP. So, in other words, GDP is not actually a very clear measure.
Wouldn't it be actually wonderful if we could get GDP down to zero and people were just getting everything we're talking about not having to pay vast amounts of rent, not having to pay vast amounts for food, you know. The more you can get that amount down, surely that's going to bring down GDP. It's almost like the whole economic system is predicated
We need better stats.
on a lie.
There are lots of thoughts on how you get a more equal society and a fairer society. How you achieve that goal.
They've given up on the goals. That's the problem.
What we're seeing here is an inequality that's been growing, as Martin says, for quite some time, which is in itself is a worry.
Okay, on to this week's phone hacking story then, and here we are at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday. Ed Miliband laying in to Prime Minister David Cameron on Andy Coulson and his decision to choose this criminal to come in to help him in Number 10.
Today we know that for 4 years, the Prime Minister's hand-picked closest advisor was a criminal and brought disgrace to Downing Street. We now also know that the Prime Minister willfully ignored multiple warnings about him. On the 8th of July 2009, The Guardian published evidence of phone hacking on an industrial scale while Andy Coulson was editor of the News of the World. At that time, Andy Coulson was his director of communications. What action did he take?
Well, as I said a moment ago, the assurances I sought and received were the same assurances received by the Press Complaints Commission, by a select committee of this House, and by police investigations. They were also thoroughly gone into by the Leveson inquiry, an inquiry he supported.
Tim Lehman, you're the councillor for King's Weston and Lib Dem. What are your thoughts on the answer there, and whether he was actually, you know, it was okay to give the guy a second chance, Andy Coulson?
Well, I can only say what I've heard, which is, you know, on the news, that it struck me as an odd situation, frankly, that all this has come to light. But of course, I think they've said that prior to this, he was actually an innocent man. So he was taken on before the trial, and now he's been convicted. So,
but he did resign, didn't he, from the News of the World because under a cloud because of the phone hacking.
Yes, you can't help but think, you know, you can't sort of shy away from the fact that there was problems, you know, before he was employed. I mean, there were rumours and suspicions about the way newspapers behave. I mean, we were talking earlier about investigative journalism, and it seems to have you know, I think it was The Guardian that opened up this story, actually, an investigative reporter. And perhaps if there was more investigative journalism, there would be less of these types of cases.
But the fact is, the investigative journalism was done, the information about Coulson was published, it was really thrown at Cameron at the time when he took on Coulson, but Cameron didn't take any notice.
Well, as with all politicians, it's a question of judgment. You know, his judgment and his... I was going to say judgment and how you're seen, you know, reacting to these things. I mean, it's a difficult thing, but did he make the right judgment? I mean, that's what the
well he said the Labour he didn't leader is. He got it wrong.
He says he did, but other people say, well, they've tried to bring his judgment and his
Cameron has fessed up to say, well, I got it wrong, you know, basically, Martin.
Yes. Well, he did.
I think underlying all, I mean, obviously, what Miliband's trying to do there is get some political capital out of the situation, but underlying the whole thing is the overmighty subject Rupert Murdoch, who. What it seems they were running is not so much a news empire, it's essentially his own private secret service, which is collecting potentially damaging information on politicians and other public figures, some of which is used for the sake of selling newspapers and other. But the other question is, what damaging information has been collected which hasn't been used?
Well, the other defendants, like Rebecca Brooks, for example, were saying, oh, well, we didn't know anything about this. Well, hang on a minute. In a newsroom, if you've got a story, everybody who is party to that story will want to know what the source is. You know, you don't just print a story not knowing what the source is.
Well, as I said, with politicians, it's judgment and integrity. That's always the thing, but I'm sure that is the case.
We had Ed Miliband turning up the other week for the Sun's support for the English football team, holding up a copy of the Sun, and of course lots of Labour MPs from Merseyside were very unhappy about that because of the Sun's role in the Hillsborough affair. But the real issue behind all of this is the too much power for Rupert Murdoch and his organisation. And ultimately, of course, if there has been criminal activity in his organisation, and this is not the only thing that Mitch Rupert Murdoch's been accused, are these people going to go to prison?
I mean, the whole process,
same as RBS and Lloyd.
The whole process that followed...
Are these people too powerful to prosecute?
The whole process that followed the phone hacking scandal, which was Nick Davis at the Guardian, by the way, Tim, that dug it out.
Right.
The whole process seems a bit flawed to me. For example, you've got the Leveson inquiry. You've got this whole judge-led inquiry into it. Leveson was pally with Elizabeth Murdoch. He was going to parties at Elizabeth Murdoch's house. He was also doing deals with her husband over quid pro quo work, free work, pro bono work, it's called, isn't it, when you're working for nothing for him. And so he was very close. Leveson was extremely close to the Murdoch family. Then we go on to the trial, and I was just discovered this week that the Prime Minister's barrister brother heads the legal chambers, which was representing Rebecca Brooks in the phone hacking defence. So, you know, the whole process was extremely close to the very pinnacle of the establishment. And I just wonder whether both of you, independently, whether you feel that the way that the judicial process, that is to say the Leveson inquiry and the court case, has been actually truly independent.
Well, I'm wondering whether it's been productive. And I mean, from my perspective, you know, if you look at the taxpayer, the cost to the taxpayer of all this, it's been absolutely enormous. And what's come out of it has been that there has been some sort of... there has been a scandal.
Martin, what about the Leveson and the court case? Do you think that's independent when you've got the Prime Minister's barrister brother representing Rebecca Brooks?
What I think here is we've got a tip of the iceberg. Coulson is going to be thrown under the bus so that others can be protected, effectively. And that's the way the British establishment
works.
Well, that's
Rebecca Brooks and Rupert Murdoch both get off scot-free.
Why hasn't Chilcot reported on Iraq yet? Because the whole purpose of inquiries and all the rest of it is essentially to put the thing to rest.
Anyway, let's hear Labour's...
I see no reason not to see these reports.
Let's hear Labour's Chris Bryant on this very topic of the Coulson conviction.
Chris Bryant.
Decline.
The Prime Minister said yesterday that he was just giving Andy Coulson a second chance. That means that the Prime Minister knew that there was a first offence.
Yeah.
And he knew from the very beginning that he was taking a criminal into Downing Street.
Yeah.
And then he refused to sack him. And yesterday, and again today, he was busy praising Andy Coulson. What message does that send to the victims? Isn't the truth of the matter that the Prime Minister's only sorry because he got caught?
Yeah.
I'm afraid that on this issue, the Honourable Gentleman has got it wrong time and time and time again. What I said about giving someone a second chance is because the individual in question had resigned as the editor of the News of the World because of what had happened. But let me just refer him to what he said in this House of Commons. He said there's no doubt that there was a deal secured between the Conservative Party and News International before the general election. That is what he said after 8 months of an inquiry that cost £5 million. That was found to be complete and utter rubbish. And yet, have we ever heard one word of retraction from the Honourable Gentleman? As ever, not a word.
Well, Chris Bright there turning it round, Martin, but ultimately it's is it you think that it was just a little bit of bad luck that Cameron and Coulson got caught?
Well, I mean, the idea that the News International don't have an intimate relationship with the Conservative Party is laughable. Of course they do. They've had one for donkey's years. I don't know what he's talking about.
Tim,
I think you just have to say the Prime Minister wasn't caught, as you put it. It was
well, that was Chris Bryant that said that. Actually,
oh, yes, he said that. Well, yeah, I mean, he's not the one on who didn't face he didn't face a trial, did he?
But he certainly did get caught with this,
he got caught
this
out,
chap.
I think is what you
caught out, maybe. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, perhaps that's more accurate way of describing it.
Okay, the future for Murdoch. Do you think they'll be supporting the Conservatives now in the next general election next year?
One wonders what all this was really all about, all this sort of, you know, get cozying up to the press, which is what has happened. And we see it, you know, quite often, political figures will, and political parties will.
What about here in Bristol? Is there any of that going on here?
Well, we can't say.
I mean, we have all political parties on this show, certainly, who will come.
I'm sure people will offer an opinion that, you know, politicians always try to cultivate the press, no matter whether they come in a party of one.
I mean, do you think
or whether they come in a party of ten.
For example, the Bristol Post is an honest broker in the city.
An honest broker for you mean?
Well, I mean, do you think they deal with all parties equally and have a fair representation?
I think they try to do that, certainly.
They fail? Succeed? Martin?
We don't always get all the stories we'd like printed. It's
do other parties?
Well, perhaps they don't either. So, or perhaps they do.
Okay, you're being really cagey on this one.
I'm a bit on
you're
top.
Being really cagey. I think
yeah.
that they just
well, put it this
support
way.
George and
put
the Tories
way, Tony,
most of the time.
If I've got a story, I often get it printed. So you know, I'm,
you do.
Yes. Yeah, so
good.
Yeah.
Well done.
He won't if he says the wrong thing on there.
You better be careful. Okay, Martin. What about locally? Do you think the situation? I mean, this is on the macro scale. This is in Westminster. It's in London. But do you think there's an issue here locally with the media, the local media, and the power they wield to actually make or break politicians? Do they do that?
Well, I mean, it's only on this show that people find out the potential misbehaviour of Hargreaves Lansdowne, for example. That's certainly not going to be covered in Bristol Evening Post, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. I think they get too much advertising revenue, or maybe they're just spending too much time down at the Merchant Venturers chit-chatting with the editor of the Evening Post. Who knows? Anyway, also this week, Wonga chased debt using fake law firms, says the Financial Conduct Authority. We've got a bit of audio on that now. This is the chief executive of Wonga, like David Cameron was about Andy Coulson, saying sorry about various different misdemeanours of Wonga, lying, sending out these fake demands for money, and also overcharging.
What we are saying sorry for is some completely unacceptable debt collection practices. We're also apologising for some unintentional systems issues that resulted in us overcharging some of our customers. These issues are completely unacceptable. We recognise that, and as a result, we will ensure that all of our customers are fully compensated. the letters were misleading and they were inappropriate, and we accept that they might well have caused upset for some of the customers who received them. We apologise sincerely. It's completely unacceptable, and this is a practice we put a stop to 4 years ago.
Well, Tim Lehman, I don't know if this is something you've come up against, people needing payday loans. Apparently, everybody that got overcharged or sent one of these fake letters by these fake law companies is going to get £5.
Well, I haven't come across this. The story is that the letters threatened legal action, and in fact they were from non-existent law firms. And it says the BBC is going to send a file to the police, and I dare say they'll be investigated by the Financial Conduct
Authority. Well, the Financial Conduct Authority has said they're not handing anything over to the police. They don't think there's going to be any criminal charges. They've set aside some money, a fiver per person, to compensate people.
As compensation. I mean, I would say there's quite a serious attempt here. If it is, as it says, as the story reads, to actually commit, you know, to defraud their customers. You cannot send letters to customers demanding, you know, a non-existent law firm. It's just and say, well, you know, that was a mistake. It requires investigation, and it's quite clear that something has gone wrong here.
Well, Martin, because people who go to Wonga are people who really are desperate, aren't they?
Yeah, I think I was just going to say, I think that is a concern, that if you're, you know, people trust these companies. I mean, they may be charging, I don't know what sort of interest rates they charge, et cetera, but, you know, people trust these companies. It does sound like advantage has been taken of people who are in a vulnerable position.
Well, that's absolutely right. And the question is, are we going to prosecute when people like this... I mean, it's quite clear. If you send a letter with a non-existent law firm in that letter, you know what you're doing. That's not an accident, is it? That's a criminal offence. Now, if somebody says, for example, reporting on their benefit situation, says something wrong in a statement they make, they get punished. They do.
But if I send you, Martin,
do Wonga get punished?
If I send you a letter, Martin, if I send you a letter,
Savile get punished?
If I send you a letter saying Gosling and Gosling law firm, pay me this money, or I'll take you to court. Surely, I mean, you know, that's it's just, if you pay it, then more for you.
No. I think that's a deliberate attempt to mislead the person you're sending the letter to. And they are, in fact, people, very vulnerable people, who, and that's why they probably did it. They thought, these people are not the sort of people who'll check whether this law firm exists. They'll just panic and pay up what we claim they owe us. And, of course, whether Wonga should be allowed to exist at all is another question.
They certainly sound very predatory to
me. Well, I'm wondering whether it's a case for trading standards, you know, as well, because looking at it, you know, it doesn't seem like, to me, like the sort of practice that a reputable firm would conduct. And you know,
well, Wonga are saying that everything's being sorted out. It could never happen again. We were hearing that, weren't we, earlier with the Savile. It can never happen again.
They would say that, wouldn't they?
That's well, the way to stop things happening again is to be vigilant and to have the rules and regulation
And jail and jail people.
And oversee what they're
doing.
They
can't do it when they're in jail, can they? Also, back to Prime Minister's questions then, and Richard Bainan was talking about the refusal of the Crown Prosecution Service here to prosecute basic assaults by carers.
Mr. Richard Bainan. Yeah.
My constituent, Michael Butcher, installed CCTV in his mother's flat because she was a dementia sufferer. And he recorded on this a brutal assault on her by her carer. Unbelievably to me, the CPS has refused to prosecute her because they say it is not in the public interest. Would my right honourable friend agree with me that, as a society, we should be totally intolerant of all attacks on vulnerable people with dementia?
On the specific case, of course, it wouldn't be right for me to comment on a CPS decision, but on the general point about, is it right that we're intolerant of breaches of care against elderly people, particularly those with dementia, who are reliant on others, yes, we should be intolerant of that. Our dementia strategy is all about not just increasing the research into trying to tackle dementia, but making sure our care homes and hospitals, and indeed communities, are become more dementia friendly.
Well, this is a pretty clear-cut case, I would have thought. You've got CCTV, clear proof of an assault on someone with dementia, but the Crown Prosecution Service say, no, we're not going to take this to court.
I don't know the full details of the case. I mean, the two words that spring to mind are Winterbourne View, you know, and any local authority at the moment anywhere is more than careful regarding any sort of case, you know, since we've had these care home problems. And, you know, I think the issue here is that it's unacceptable.
Martin, very, very quickly, just 10 seconds or so.
Yes, also there is a question about how we manage care for people with dementia. I think that privatisation in this area has been particularly pernicious.
OK, time now for the Murdoch News. You heard it, yes, the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest, that's Lib Dem councillor for King's West and Tim Leem. And after the news, the campaign for accountability of American bases and independence from America.
Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award.